Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, a musical meditation for the Feast of Corpus Christi, the Vatican and the Venice Biennale, spotlight on John the 23rd to mark the 50th anniversary of his death, which falls on June the 3rd. But first, a report on Pope Francis's weekly general audience. That's with Chris Altieri.
Neither Pope Francis nor the thousands of people who had begun to gather for the Holy Father's weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square even before daybreak allowed the sudden rainstorm that blew through the city of Rome on Wednesday morning to dampen their spirits. After thanking the pilgrims and tourists for their courage in braving the weather,
complimenti per il vostro coraggio sotto la pioggia. Bravi, eh?
And listening to a reading from the Gospel according to St. John, in which the episode of the soldiers piercing the crucified Lord's side is recounted, Pope Francis began a new series of catechetical reflections centered on the mystery of the Church as presented through some well-known phrases from the documents of the Second Vatican Council.
Tutta la storia della salvezza è la storia di Dio che cerca l'uomo, gli offre il suo amore, lo accoglie.
The whole history of salvation, said the Holy Father, is the story of God seeking man, offering humanity his love, embracing mankind. The Holy Father went on to recall how God called Abraham to be the father of a multitude, chose the people of Israel to forge an alliance that embraces all nations, and sent in the fullness of time his Son, that his plan of love and salvation might be realized in a new and everlasting covenant with humanity. When we read the Gospels, he said, we see that Jesus gathers around him a small community that receives his word, follows him, shares his journey, becomes his family. And with this community, he prepares and builds his church. It was a theme to which the Holy Father returned in his remarks to English language pilgrims, which he delivered through an interpreter.
Like the merciful Father in the parable of the prodigal son, God wants all of us to live in his love and to share in his life. The Church is an essential part of this divine plan. We were made to know and love God, and despite our sins, he continues to call us to return to him. In the fullness of time, he sent his Son into our world to inaugurate the new and eternal covenant with humanity through his sacrifice on the cross. The Church was born of this supreme act of reconciling love in the water and blood which flowed from Christ's pierced side. At Pentecost, the Holy Spirit sent the apostles to proclaim the gospel of God's love to the ends of the earth. Christ can never be separated from his Church, which he has made the great family of God's children.
Today, concluded Pope Francis, let us pledge ourselves to renewing our love for the Church and to letting her be God's true family, where everyone feels welcomed, understood, and loved. I'm Chris Altieri.
And voila, thanks there go to Chris Altieri. Why not join Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who brings us a timely musical meditation, which focuses on the Feast of Corpus Christi.
Thank you. the Brigittine convent in Rome, the design on the tabernacle door shows a pelican feeding its young. With its long beak, the pelican bites its breast, releasing drops of blood to feed the young. That image has captured the imaginations of writers and artists over the centuries, from ancient Egypt right through to the present. Shakespeare and Dante both used it. And so did St. Thomas Aquinas in a hymn he wrote about the great gift of the Eucharist, when Christ feeds us with his own body and blood. The feast of Corpus Christi was established during St. Thomas's lifetime. He probably wrote many of the prayers we use in the liturgy on this feast. And he also wrote some fine hymns in honour of the Blessed Sacrament, not only Adoro Te, that we just heard, but also O Salutaris Ostia and Tantum Ergo, that we sing at benediction. The Church's teaching on the Eucharist is explored thoroughly in St. Thomas's theological writings, but the heart of it is expressed beautifully and simply in his Eucharistic hymns. O Thou, our reminder of Christ crucified, living bread, the life of us for whom he died, lend this life to me then, feed and feast my mind. There be thou the sweetness man was meant to find. Visus actus tuus tuus in te fallitu. St. Thomas develops the idea of the pelican feeding its young with its own blood. One drop of our Lord's precious blood, he says, is enough to redeem the world. So you often see a pelican used in Christian art as a symbol for the Eucharist. Corpus Christi College in Oxford, founded just before the Reformation, has a pelican proudly perched on top of the column in the front quadrangle. Now, I don't know whether any of you have ever tried translating Latin hymns into English. It isn't easy. And if you want to try and use the same plainsong tune for the English version, you really need to be a genius. Fortunately, a genius was at hand to translate St. Thomas's Adoro Te in the person of the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. Another skillful translator of Latin hymns was Edward Caswall, a priest who entered the Birmingham Oratory shortly after it was founded by John Henry Newman in the mid-19th century. Father Caswall's name crops up everywhere in Catholic hymn books, mainly for his translations, but also for some texts of his own, like See Amid the Winter's Snow and O Jesus Christ, Remember. Let's listen now to his translation of St. Thomas's Adoro Te. O Godhead hid, devoutly I adore thee. That tune is called Aquinas, appropriately enough, and it was written by Sir Richard Terry, first master of music at Westminster Cathedral. The cathedral is dedicated to the Most Precious Blood, and as you enter the Blessed Sacrament chapel there, you see a lovely bronze pelican lovingly shedding its blood. As we celebrate the Feast of Corpus Christi, we could use this hymn to help us in our prayer. The words of St. Thomas, translated by Gerard Manley Hopkins or by Edward Caswall, offer us plenty of food for thought and food for prayer.
And warm thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And going from music to art for the first time ever, beginning Saturday 1st of June, the Vatican is taking part with its own pavilion at Venice's 55th Biennale, held every 2 years in this lagoon city. The participation explained at a recent press conference on Tuesday 14th of May by the President of the Pontifical Council for Culture, Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi, who told us that among those commissioned by the Vatican to do an exhibit for this Biennale was renowned American artist Lawrence Carroll. He was asked by the Holy See to prepare an instalment entitled Recreation for the festival. Susie Hodges spoke to him.
Your reaction when you were approached by the Holy See to take part in this exhibit? Were you surprised?
I was surprised. I received a very formal letter in my apartment in Venice, and I don't think I told anyone for several months. I waited 2 or 3 months before I contacted anyone. I wanted to, in a way, digest it and understand it and to know who was involved and what the ideas were behind it, to feel comfortable to enter a project like this. So I waited, I think, quite a long time before agreeing to do the project.
I know that you're working on the recreation aspect of this exhibit, which, of course, is inspired by the book of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what your work is seeking to portray and how you are portraying it.
They never really asked anything of me. They sent me the text of the idea behind the project, which I think I casually maybe passed through one time. Not to be to push away the idea, but when I work, I need complete freedom with where I go with my work. I didn't want anything to catch me or to trip me that I felt like I had to, in a way, illustrate. I wanted to be completely independent with the work. I trusted the fact that they chose my work because of the work that I've done over the last 30 years. And I felt if I stayed true to what I do, that it would certainly be able to, in a way, fit into what they were saying. Instead of my work trying to fit in what they were saying, I would rather make work in a way outside of an idea and true to what I do, and then place it to where they felt they saw something in my work that they felt, in a way, close to their ideas. And that's how I approached this project.
So how did you portray this theme of recreation?
Well, my work has been about, for a long time, about the idea that ideas and things, the possibility for them to have another life, that they, for example, an idea can be carried through generation after generation and placed in the hands of another artist when they might look at a work from an artist from a previous generation. And they might look at something like I might look at an artist, for example, like Morandi or Giotto or a more contemporary artist like Twombly. And you look at their work and you take away something with you and you really carry it with you. And you try to unfold something that they've given you into your own work in your own way, in the spirit of their work, not in trying to duplicate something that they've made. No, but there's a certain quality to certain works that affect me that I try to find that in my own work. And I think through this project, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to carry something forward, to bring something, to renew something in a way. And hopefully with my work, for a younger artist one day to see what I have done, to take this and open it up in their own work and be able to interpret, translate, produce something in their own way, in their own form, an idea, ideas that have been around for a long time. And to continue this, you know, to continue this dialogue of those that came before us and to try to carry something forward. My work has been, from the beginning, when I was a young artist in New York, leaving from Los Angeles, was important for me to have something that I felt was my own, but also something that was connected to something behind me, looking over the bridge back at what's behind you from where you came. And you're trying, in a way, to connect to that, but also to bring it into the present. I think this is what a lot of painters do. You know, they look back at other artists and they try to find something in the work to bring into their own work, to bring into where we live now. We're not living in the 1940s or 50s or the early 1920s when Morandi, for example, was in Bologna. It's a different time. It's a different context. It's a different politics. But there's something about his work that escapes that. And I would like my work also to escape a certain time. I wouldn't want to think, oh, this is an artist who painted this in 1985 or 1993 or 2010. I would like something to be more independent of the moment, that's able to transcend something, to be able to be placed in another arena, for example. I mean, when I go to Assisi, for example, to visit the frescoes of Giotto and the Basilica of San Francesco, which I did recently, which I've done for many years, you know, I'm void of the context of the time and the politics of the time, but there's something deeply humanly connected to the work that I feel when I look at the frescoes of Giotto. There's a palpable humanity that's inherent in his work, void sometimes even of the subject, to know that there's something in there that's still giving me something. And I hope one day my work can also do this. And that's a thread to the past, to the future, a bridge from Assisi to a young boy in California who didn't even know what Assisi was until 25, 30 years ago. I mean,
and what's been the early advance feedback, you know, before the exhibition opens? What have people been saying? Do you think they've understood what you've been trying
well,
to portray?
Well, nobody has seen what I've done. You know, I didn't have nobody in the Vatican, in the commission of the curatorial team, visited my studio until I think a week or so ago. So I've kept everything. I've kept everybody away. I needed to be protected in the sense of my working process, because I'm still making the work. I still have some work to do.
How long ago then did you start working on it?
As soon as I said yes to the project, I started
Which
to
was...
think about it in November, October, or visiting the space and thinking about what I might do and trying to put some shape to its form.
Going back a bit to what you did in the past, mm-hmm. you were famous for exploring paintings that would move away from the frame, the mm-hmm. so-called table paintings. Tell us a little bit briefly about why you started upon this and what sort of inspired you to do it.
From the beginning, my work had a very sculptural component to it. My early works were much small in scale. I had a small studio, and we're talking now about early 1980s in New York City. I'd left Los Angeles. I didn't look so much at painting per se, but I looked a lot at sculpture. It was interesting, the form of the sculpture, the box-like quality of it. It was very inviting to me to wonder that a painting can have not just one facade, but it could have a sculptural component. It could have what you see is not always what you get. So there's a front and there's a side and there's a bottom and a top. So I started to exaggerate this with my work. I started to give my work more of a sculptural dimension to it. And I think slowly through the years, this language evolved. I was able to say, okay, if there's a sculptural component and the work is a box-like sculptural in a way, that there's also an inside and an outside. And if I was to cut into the work, that it would reveal something. It would expose something. It would take away a facade in a way, and it would invite another kind of belief into what painting could be. And I think through this slow exploration through the years, I was able to develop into what you say are these sort of gestural table paintings. It's just a continuation of ideas that have slowly unfolded into my own language in a way, informed by other things, of course, around me. I don't think an artist works solely alone. I think everything comes from somewhere. You know, you look at the work of Picasso, and they say, oh, he's this genius with this, but he looked so much at the primitive African mask and this sort of stylization of the form of the mask and the stylization of the reduction using this sort of African language of the exaggeration of the eyes, the nose, and he brought this element into Paris at a time when nobody was paying attention to it. But it didn't come from a dream. It didn't come from him inventing this. It was already there. He saw something that was neglected in a way or wasn't brought into the spotlight of fashion or the spotlight of something that was necessarily important to look at. And I think something that I do is that I've been fortunate enough, if I have any gift, I think it's the gift of looking at simple things in life. And I think this comes from my family, you know, family that were immigrants to America, my mother from Ireland, my father from Australia, not with a lot of money. We had to, as my parents were young parents in America, they never threw anything away. They would fix the hole in my pants. They would fix the chair if it was broken. Everything had another life. It wasn't just taken away and disposed.
It was salvaged.
Yes, and I think for my work, this idea of giving something another life, of continuing an idea that might have been forgotten or thrown away or looked tired or out of fashion, but to me still had value. And this has always been important to my work. One misconception with my work that I'd like to really make clear is that often when people see my work, they think that I find these discarded, used objects by the side of the road. It's not true. Everything within my studio starts new. It has the materials I buy, I bring into the studio, and the process that they go through, the life that they go through, is something that is inherited and resolved through the studio. There's a big difference between finding something on the street that already has a history and then making something in your studio that has its own history.
Thanks there go to American artist Lawrence Carroll. And of course to Susie Hodges for bringing us this interview. Meanwhile, as promised last week, I'd like to bring you the third part in a series focusing on the figure of good Pope John, the ordinary man who astonished the world by calling the Second Vatican Council, simply because on Monday, 3rd of June, we mark the 50th anniversary of his death. Pope John is a Roman pontiff who has also gone down in history for his role in peacemaking. But why don't you listen to this feature I've put together for you, focusing on this particular aspect of his pontificate. It was 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis raised the spectre of a nuclear war. A Roman pontiff had been working behind the scenes to avoid this confrontation, his name Pope John XXIII. He voiced his concern for peace through the microphones of Vatican Radio.
Nous supplions tous les gouvernants qu'ils fassent tout ce qui est en eux pour sauver la paix.
The date was the 25th of October. Speaking in French, Pope John XXIII highlighted the responsibility of world leaders to avoid a war that would have unpredictable and horrific effects. He appealed to them to listen to the cry of anguish reaching out from people from the four corners of the earth, a cry for peace.
Qu'ils écoutent le cri angoissé, paix.
The world leaders he was appealing to were the first Catholic president of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and communist Russian Premier Nikita Khrushchev. It's hard to think of this gentle pope, best remembered as good Pope John, as having really had such an instrumental role in helping world leaders back away gracefully from terrifying confrontation. But it seems he was quick to respond when the opportunity to act as a mediator arose.
We know that immediately before President Kennedy had made contact with Pope John XXIII, so the initiative came there from President Kennedy and the American side.
Church historian, Jesuit Norman Tanner, sheds light on how Pope John XXIII was able to influence this crisis situation. But Professor Tanner is also careful to warn against any exaggeration of this role as a papal peacemaker, a role difficult to measure, best described as a factor in the crisis situation rather than a crucial intervention, one Americans weren't particularly keen to publicise at the time.
True, it hasn't been greatly publicised from the American side because Kennedy especially didn't want to give the impression that he was too much under Vatican influence, being the first Catholic president, so that side of things had to be kept quiet a bit. But it's clear from later records that, yes, Kennedy did approach the Pope. On the Russian side, too, we know that there were contacts with Pope John XXIII just before this broadcast, and we know later that Khrushchev publicly acknowledged his gratitude and his debt to John XXIII for, as it were, letting him off the hook, giving him reason for withdrawing the ships which were carrying the missiles to Cuba.
And Russian Premier Khrushchev's gratitude transpired once again when, less than a year after this crisis, on learning of the death of Pope John, he sent a cable to the Vatican expressing condolences. It ran as follows.
We retain good memories of John XXIII, whose fruitful activities for the maintenance and strengthening of peace have earned wide recognition and won him the respect of peace-loving peoples.
And it was to peace-loving peoples that the elderly Pope John dedicated his last encyclical, Pacem in Terris, or Peace on Earth. in which he called for social and international peace. With this document, which can be perceived as his last testament, published as it was only a couple of months before his death, he broke new ground by addressing it not as tradition dictated to the hierarchy, clergy, and Catholic faithful, but to all men of good will.
He's not coming out of it so much from a purely Catholic position, and he is appealing to all nations, all states. That worldwide dimension is at least a new emphasis. Perhaps before John the 23rd, there was more emphasis on peace with justice, that the rights of a Catholic state, a Catholic society to defend itself. But John the 23rd perhaps appealed more simply to human nature, human rights, and the importance of peace in itself for all people, and in a way, as it were, transcended the immediate concerns of the Catholic Church.
A quality President Kennedy himself attributed to Pope John the 23rd in his message to the Vatican on receiving the news of the Roman Pontiff's death.
He was the chosen leader of world Catholicism, but his concern for the human spirit transcended all boundaries of belief or geography. The ennobling precepts of his encyclicals and his actions drew on the accumulated wisdom of an ancient faith for guidance in the most complex and troublesome problems of the modern age.
And less than a month later, when the young American president came to the Vatican on an official visit to the newly elected Pope Paul VI.
Great joy, we welcome Your Excellency to the Vatican.
He did not fail to mention Pope John the 23rd and his encyclical Pacem in Terris. Proof, perhaps, that whereas the exact relevance of the role Pope John the 23rd played in the Cuban Missile Affair is impossible to assess, his words did help diffuse a crisis situation. And our thanks there go to our guest speaker, renowned historian and well-known author, Jesuit Professor Norman Tanner. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget that we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va and then click on the English World icon. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.